What would your life look like if fear was not an option? Find out in the new series, Them, The Scare. It's an all-new installment of the horror anthology, now streaming only on Prime Video. The series takes place in Los Angeles in the early 90s, with a city on edge of complete chaos. Deborah Iorindi returns this season as LAPD homicide detective Dawn Reeve, who has been assigned to solve a new case that has left even the most hardened detectives shaken, to find the South Side Slayer. As she gives everything to uncover the truth, something horrific and supernatural begins to haunt her and her family. Them, The Scare features the legendary Pam Grier, Luke James, Wayne Knight, plus many more, and is sure to keep you guessing at every turn. Horror fans, get ready for your new obsession. This is something you do not want to miss. And remember, fear is not an option. Watch Them, The Scare on Prime Video, now streaming.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Greetings, my friends. Today, we're venturing into the heart of Washington State, a place known for its stunning landscapes and, less famously, for haunting mysteries. Today, we will unravel the eerie legends of the Murray Island incident. And here's a little tip. Put on those tinfoil hats. We will dive into the dark history of Starvation Heights, and then we will step into the ghostly corridors of the Oxford Saloon. These stories remain ingrained in Washington's past, and they remind us that sometimes the truth is stranger than the fiction. So let's dim the lights and settle in. And let's explore the shadows of the Evergreen State together. What do you say? Do you believe in ghosts? Join me on a journey through America's dark and haunted past as we explore the ghost stories and folklore that have been passed down for generations. What scares you? Let's find out. I'm Christopher Feinstein, and this is Haunted American History. Now, although it's relatively unknown, the 1947 Murray Island incident holds a significant place in the annals of Washington State's UFO occurrences. Its obscurity, however, should not overshadow its importance, as it possesses several intriguing aspects that warrant further explanation. Notably, it represents perhaps the earliest instance where a witness reported encountering a mysterious man in black, a shadowy figure who employed intimidation tactics to enforce silence. Remarkably, this incident predates the renowned Roswell crash, yet striking similarities can be drawn between the two events. Furthermore, the tragic demise of two military intelligence officers assigned to investigate the sighting adds another layer of intrigue to this already captivating tale. I'm actually a little nervous to talk about it. I'm gonna knock at the door. Hey, why are you letting people know about this? It's my job, man. In the year 1947, the waters of Puget Sound possessed a common hazard in the form of floating logs. These logs, having escaped from timber mills on the nearby shoreline, drifted atop the surface, creating potential obstacles for seafarers. To address this issue, a group of men took up an informal role of harbor patrol, diligently retrieving these wayward logs and delivering them to the mills in exchange for a salvage fee. Among their ranks was a man named Harold Dahl, who manned one of the patrol boats, with his supervisor on shore being none other than Fred Chrisman. Now, Chris, you say that name, Fred Chrisman, like I should know who that is. Well, for those of you who don't wear a tinfoil hat, like most people do, like, well, not most people like me, Fred Chrisman is known to some as, like, He's like the grandfather of conspiracy theories. He was connected to paranormal, UFO, the JFK assassination, you name it. If you dive into any kind of conspiracy, Fred Chrisman's name is going to come up. On that fateful June 21st afternoon, Dahl found himself aboard his patrol boat alongside his son and a couple of other men and their faithful canine companion. Aww. It's always nice to have a dog with you. As their vessel neared the east shore of Murray Island, an island that's now connected to Vashon Island by a causeway road and situated roughly 6 miles from Des Moines, Washington, Dahl's eyes were drawn upward to the sky. And what he saw there was nothing short of extraordinary. Six objects suspended about 2,000 feet above their ship. These objects possessed a peculiar construction. Crafted from a reflective metal and fashioned in the shape of donuts with a diameter approximately 100 feet. And notably, each craft featured a central hole measuring around 25 feet in diameter, alongside round portholes of what Dahl believed to be an observation window. Curiously, five of the crafts encircled the sixth, which descended gradually until it hovered a mere 500 feet above the water's surface. Now, filled with anxiety that the center aircraft might collide with their boat, Dahl swiftly steered toward the shore. And once he was safely there, he hurried to retrieve his camera and captured several images of the extraordinary spectacle unfolding above them. The lower ship maintained its position for approximately 5 minutes, while the others continued their aerial dance overhead. Then one of the ships broke formation and descended, establishing contact with the lower craft. The two remained in close proximity for several minutes until suddenly, Dahl heard a resounding thud. In an instant, thousands of pieces of what he initially perceived to be newspapers cascaded from the interior of the central ship. Most of the strange debris descended into the bay, while some fragments found their way onto the beach. Dahl managed to salvage a few pieces, discovering that they consisted of a lightweight white metal. However, alongside this unusual material, the ship also disgorged approximately 20 tons of dark metal resembling lava rock. As these molten rocks made contact with the water's surface, they emitted scorching heat, causing steam to erupt from their collision. Seeking shelter from the falling debris that damaged his boat, Dahl and his companions took cover. Tragically, during this chaotic onslaught, one piece struck Dahl's son in the arm, leaving him with severe burns, while another fragment proved fatal for their loyal canine companion. God damn it! The dog always gets it! Come on! Probably such a good boy. Well, following this, I can't even talk, I'm so upset. Yeah, Chris, that's why you can't talk. Following this astonishing display, the strange crafts ascended into the sky and embarked on a westward trajectory out to sea. Dahl promptly returned to his boat and attempted to radio for assistance, only to discover that his communication equipment had unexplainably malfunctioned. Determined to seek aid, they set sail back toward the dock, bidding farewell to their faithful canine companion by gently releasing its lifeless form into the watery depths. Come on, you had to bring it up again? Dahl then rushed his injured son to the hospital for urgent medical attention before confiding in his boss, Fred Chrisman, about the extraordinary events that had just unfolded. In a bid to provide tangible evidence of their encounter, Dahl entrusted Chrisman with the camera containing the photographic records of this otherworldly experience. Upon developing the prints, they were astounded to find that the strange airships were indeed captured on film. However, upon closer examination, it became apparent that the negatives bore peculiar spots reminiscent of film damage by exposure to radiation. Although skeptical of Dahl's account, Chrisman nonetheless returned to Murray Island, intent on gathering rock samples as evidence. It was during this venture that he claimed an airship materialized above him, as if observing his every move. Intrigued by these astounding claims, publisher Ray Palmer of Chicago received a package from Dahl and Chrisman containing a box filled with fragments of the mysterious metal, alongside detailed statements recounting the strange occurrences. A few weeks later, Palmer reached out to Kenneth Arnold, who had recently begun investigating UFO phenomena. In late July, Arnold arrived to Tacoma accompanied by airline pilot E.J. Smith. Together, they met with Dahl and Chrisman, meticulously examining Dahl's boat and conducting interviews. However, despite their best efforts, Dahl and Chrisman failed to produce the photographic evidence they had entrusted to Chrisman earlier. Adding further intrigue to this unfolding saga, Dahl informed Arnold that his son had mysteriously disappeared, although he later claimed that his son had been found working in Montana as a waiter, although the circumstances of his journey remained unclear. On the afternoon of July 31st, Captain Lee Davidson and First Lieutenant Frank Brown of the U.S. Army Air Force flew to Tacoma from Hamilton Field, California. Notably, Davidson and Brown were not only skilled pilots but also intelligence specialists, possessing the necessary expertise to investigate such extraordinary claims. They engaged in lengthy discussions with Arnold, Smith, and Chrisman, expressing a tentative belief that there might be some truth to this story. However, they had to cut their investigation short. They needed to depart by midnight in order to get back to Hamilton Field on August 1st, the day the Air Force was scheduled to split from the Army. Consequently, at approximately 2 o'clock in the morning, the two officers departed McCord Airfield aboard a B-25 bomber, accompanied by two other crew members. Tragically, merely 20 minutes into their flight, disaster struck as the plane crashed near Centralia, Washington. Davidson and Brown lost their lives in this catastrophic event, marking them as the Air Force's first casualties. In the aftermath of this tragedy, Dahl and Chrisman alleged that the Air Force officer had taken some of the peculiar metal fragments on board their ill-fated flight. Now with this, rumors began circulating, suspecting that anti-aircraft guns had brought down the plane, a sinister attempt to silence those who had uncovered vital information. Anonymous phone calls flooded local newspapers and the FBI, asserting that the plane's destruction had been orchestrated as a cover-up. According to these anonymous sources, Brown and Davidson had stumbled upon classified information that necessitated their elimination. Promptly by these disturbing claims and the loss of life, the Air Force expanded its investigation while the FBI launched its own parallel inquiry. The subsequent investigation conducted by the Air Force officials concluded that the plane crash had been an unfortunate accident. A fire had erupted in one of the engines, prompting the men on board to initiate emergency protocols. Tragically, before Brown and Davidson could bail out, a wing snapped off and collided with the tail section, causing it to sever from the aircraft. The plane, now spiraling out of control, trapped the men within its doomed frame. Another Air Force investigator assigned to interview Dahl and Chrisman and inspect their boat expressed reservations about their accounts. The damage he observed did not align with the destruction described by the two sailors. Moreover, there were no piles of metal fragments littering Maury Island as they had claimed. The samples he examined bore a striking resemblance to slag typically produced in metal smelters. His conclusions aligned closely with those reached by FBI investigators. Dahl and Chrisman had likely fabricated the incident as a means to generate publicity for a magazine article. The FBI, cautioning Dahl and Chrisman against perpetuating their hoax, warned them that their efforts had failed. They offered them a deal whereby if the two men ceased discussing the matter, the government would refrain from prosecuting them for their fraudulent actions, which had inadvertently resulted in the tragic deaths of two officers. Initially, Dahl and Chrisman complied with the FBI directive, publicly declaring that their story was indeed a fabrication while steadfastly refusing any further interviews on the subject. However, a few years later, in the January 1950 issue of Fate magazine, Chrisman recanted his earlier claims, affirming that the incident had genuinely occurred. Kenneth Arnold also lent credence to their account by including the Maury Island incidents in his 1952 book, The Coming of the Saucers. Today, opinions regarding the veracity of Dahl and Chrisman's claims remain divided. Many people believe that the two men concocted an elaborate ruse that spiraled out of control, perpetrating a hoax that captivated the public's imagination. others entertain more conspiratorial notions, suggesting that a shadowy government agency orchestrated events to conceal secrets ranging from UFO encounters to potentially nefarious activities, such as nuclear waste disposal in Puget Sound. Some even propose that this clandestine organization sabotaged the B-25 bomber, eliminating the investigators while simultaneously implicating Dahl and Chrisman. In recent years, investigators have made their way to the crash site in hopes of uncovering tangible evidence, perhaps remnants of the strange rocks mentioned by Dahl and Chrisman, that might shed light on this enduring mystery. Yet, despite their efforts, no definitive answers have emerged, leaving the enigma of the Murray Island incident shrouded in uncertainty and open to interpretation. Hey folks, I'm going to keep this short and sweet. Just wanted to say thanks for the overwhelming support and the reviews coming. The Apple reviews, you have an uptick. You guys are still far, far beneath the Spotify reviews. I mean, the Spotify ratings are through the roof and the Spotify comments are through the roof. I'd like there to be more on Apple. But hey, listen, you guys are doing a great job. Thank you so much. What's also cool is that those of you that are leaving reviews on Spotify, if you have a question or a comment or something that you want to leave on Spotify, but you might want an answer to that, the best place to do that is to go to the episode on YouTube and leave the comment there, because those I can actually like reply to. So if you really want to, you know, have a discourse with me or a back and forth or just a comment or just a question about an episode, leave it on YouTube and I, you know, when I see it, I'll get to it. I'm not saying that I'm going to get to all of them. I'm going to try. I do try to answer any emails that I get, but you know, things happen. Anywho, also I have exciting news. Tomorrow, Tuesday, November. What the hell is wrong with me? March 19th. Why would I say November? Jeez Louises. The Nightmare Collective launches. Officially. This is the official launch. It launches tomorrow. And it's going to be weekly every Tuesday. So please, if you miss my fiction, that's where all my fiction's going to go. So this Haunted American History is going to be reserved for just that. Haunted American History. And the Nightmare Collective is going to be my fiction stories, as well as the gentleman I am doing this show with. So it's going to be their stories and my stories. I am narrating my episodes. I'm narrating some of theirs. I'm doing introductions to all of them. So you get to hear my lovely voice at the beginning and end of every episode, and sometimes making up the entire episode. But we didn't slack when it comes to voice talent. We have some of the best people that we know. We didn't go the route of just hiring voice actors. We went the route of hiring people who we know personally who can deliver. And this first episode, oh my God, you guys are going to be so... If you're into the fiction stories that I write, I cannot wait to hear what you guys think of this. So please head on over to wherever you listen to podcasts and subscribe to The Nightmare Collective. That starts tomorrow. The Zachary Bain Kickstarter, I think we have about 4 days left. We're only about 25% of the way through. So it's probably, unless a miracle happens, it's probably not going to get funded. But that doesn't mean it's over. Listen, it's going to live on somewhere, whether I finish the book myself, or it maybe it'll breathe life at a new place. Perhaps the Nightmare Collective might take on the reins of the Zachary Bain saga and really flesh it out and maybe do a series. Maybe for Halloween time? I don't know. It's something we've been throwing around. So please head over there, check it out. Also, some of my original stories here from way back in the day that I wanted to remaster, I'm going to do it over there because that's just where it fits. And I'm going to expand on them, maybe cast some of them, do some. I'm going to have a lot of fun. And we got a ton of originals, reimaginings, all fun stuff coming to the Nightmare Collective. So thank you all so much. And yeah, let's keep cruising with Washington. Love you, folks. Later.
What would your life look like if fear was not an option? Find out in the new series, Them, The Scare. It's an all-new installment of the horror anthology, now streaming only on Prime Video. The series takes place in Los Angeles in the early 90s, with a city on edge of complete chaos. Deborah Iorindi returns this season as LAPD homicide detective Don Reeve, who has been assigned to solve a new case that has left even the most hardened detectives shaken, to find the South Side Slayer. As she gives everything to uncover the truth, something horrific and supernatural begins to haunt her and her family. Them, the Scare, features the legendary Pam Grier, Luke James, Wayne Knight, plus many more, and is sure to keep you guessing at every turn. Horror fans, get ready for your new obsession. This is something you do not want to miss. And remember, fear is not an option. Watch Them, the Scare, on Prime Video, now streaming.
The community of Olaya, nestled just across the Puget Sound from Seattle, held a peculiar duality. Its name, derived from the local tribal jargon, meant berry, a fitting tribute to the area's well-renowned strawberries. Festivals erupted in celebration of these succulent fruits, where people indulged in an abundance of berry-laden cuisine. Yet, amidst the vibrant community, a dark history lurked, one that revolved around starvation and death. At the heart of Olaya's grim tale stood Linda Burfield Hazard, a self-proclaimed doctor who transformed her humble cottage into the infamous Wilderness Heights Sanitarium. From the 1890s to 1912, she rented out the attic space to patients seeking her radical cures. Though lacking medical credentials, Hazard practiced a form of homeopathy and fervently believed in the power of fasting as a remedy for all her ailments. In her book, Fasting for the Cure of Disease, she boldly claimed that her treatment could cure everything from cancer to constipation. The regime she imposed on her patients was severe. They were only allowed a meager bowl of tomato or asparagus soup once per day for over 40 days. Alongside this near-starvation diet, they were subjected to long walks, enemas, and vigorous massages. The energy of those who ventured on daily walks from the cottage to the store gradually dissipated, transforming their once energetic strolls to feeble crawls as their bodies wasted away. While technically free to leave the Wilderness Heights at any time, Hazard and her supposed cure seemed to hold an inexplicable power over her patients. Local farmers observed as these emaciated souls embarked on their daily journeys, their skeletal frames haunting reminders of the toll Hazard's treatment exacted. The number of lives claimed by Hazard's cure remains uncertain, with estimates ranging from 24 to over 40, and possibly even higher. Hazard took on a role of attending physician for her patients, performing autopsies herself. The makeshift autopsy table consisted of an ironing board placed over a bathtub in the cottage, where she dissected these frail bodies. She rarely bothered with death certificates, instead maintaining a clandestine arrangement with a discreet funeral home in Seattle for burials. Remarkably, most patients who succumbed to their illness left behind all of their property, conveniently bequeathing it to Hazard. Unbeknownst to many, her husband Sam had a tarnished past, having been expelled from the United States Army for forgery and embezzlement. In 1911, tragedy struck when British heiresses Claire and Dora Williamson sought treatment at Wilderness Heights. Both sisters endured a horrifying ordeal, losing over 50% of their body weight. While Dora barely clung to life, Claire tragically succumbed to the merciless grip of starvation. Someone had also embezzled money from the sisters' bank accounts to compound their misfortune. The British consulate intervened, leading to Hazard's conviction for manslaughter in 1913. Surprisingly, her prison sentence lasted less than 2 years before she embarked on a journey to New Zealand, where she continued her bizarre medical practice. In 1920, she returned to Olaya and constructed a grand sanitarium and nursing home. This time, however, local authorities kept a watchful eye, ensuring that none of her patients suffered the same fate as the ill-fated Williamsons. The true nature of Hazard's intentions remains shrouded in mystery. It is unclear whether she meticulously planned to murder her patients or if the deaths were an unintended consequence of her misguided beliefs. When affluent patients, those without influential connections, began to fall gravely ill under her care, Hazard and her husband may have seized the opportunity to inherit their estates. Perhaps Hazard herself failed to comprehend the gravity of her actions, making her more of a mass murderer than a calculated serial killer. Firmly convinced in the efficiency of her fasting cure, she genuinely believed that those who perished were beyond saving. And in a cruel twist of fate, Hazard succumbed to her own cure in the 1940s, falling victim to the very treatment that she had championed. Author Greg Olson meticulously researched Linda Hazard and her haunting sanitarium in Olaya, chronicling the chilling tale in his book, Starvation Heights. In the 1990s, he ventured to the former location of Wilderness Heights with author Jeff Davis for a first-hand experience. At that time, a family with two children resided in the house, which had remained remarkably unchanged since Hazard and her husband had lived there. Over the years, the family encountered eerie phenomena within the house's walls. One particular incident occurred when the woman of the house was cooking dinner in the kitchen. Oblivious to what was unfolding behind her, she moved back and forth between the counter and the stove. And when she eventually turned around, a shocking sight awaited her. Every chair in the kitchen, and even a few from the adjacent room, had inexplicably piled up against the bathroom door. To add a more mystique surrounding Starvation Heights, numerous paranormal experiences have been reported. In the attic where Hazard's patients once reside, several low ledges served as storage spaces for small items. According to a psychic who visited the site, she sensed the presence of spirits, those unfortunate victims too terrified to move even in death. Overwhelmed by the anguish that seemed to permeate every inch of the house, the psychic burst into tears on multiple occasions. The Washington State Paranormal Investigation and Research Team, also known as WSPIR, W-S-P-I-R, that's really clever, undertook three visits to Starvation Heights between 2005 and 2006. During their first investigation, they divided into teams, each accompanied by a psychic. To maintain secrecy, the psychics were blindfolded and placed into separate cars. As the journey commenced, technicians sat beside the psychics, recording their every action and statement with video cameras. Interestingly, two of the psychics sensed that they were headed toward a large institution with some connection to medicine. When they finally arrived at the cottage, their blindfolds were removed and any communication between the psychics was strictly prohibited. Each psychic embarked on a solo exploration of the house. During one visit, WSPIR investigators Jill and Darren accompanied psychic Marilyn as she ascended the stairs. Marilyn's attention was immediately drawn to a book lying before her. As she picked it up and read the title, her expression contorted with disappointment. It was a copy of Hazard's famous book, Fasting for the Cure of Disease. Marilyn felt that this knowledge tainted her impressions of the house. Curiosity piqued, Darren inquired about the book with the owners. They admitted to owning a copy, but had intentionally hidden it to avoid prying eyes, so they were perplexed as to how it had found its way out into the open in the house. WSPIR investigators managed to capture compelling evidence on both video and audio recordings. In one instance, a team recorded a video that began inside their car before panning outside. The microphone picked up a muffled statement uttered by a team member. The video then shifted back inside the car, revealing a chilling surprise. A strange, breathy voice pleading for help. This voice could have only emanated from within the car itself, ruling out the possibility of it being made by anyone inside or outside the vehicle. During another investigation, while walking toward a ravine believed to be a potential burial site for Hazard's victims, a WSPIR team captured pictures and audio recordings. On their audio recorder, a voice distinctly asked, "Are you talking about me now?" Perplexing, the team members did not hear the voice at any time, continuing their conversation oblivious to its presence. Another voice seemed to echo saying, "Take us up," or "Dig us up." Concerned that the cottage would soon be demolished to make way for a new house on the property, WSPIR hastily organized a third investigation. Several members spent the night within its walls, and to their astonishment, one man who had never experienced any psychic phenomena before felt an otherworldly presence reaching out to him as he relaxed in the room where Linda Hazard had met her demise. He entered a trance-like state, responding to simple questions with deep rumbles of yes or no emanating from his chest. It appeared as though he had established communication with Linda Hazard herself, who stubbornly refused to depart and adamantly resisted any attempts to demolish the house. However, fate intervened as the family residing in the house decided to move on, resulting in the eventual demolition of Starvation Heights. Was this final communication a product of an overactive imagination or a desperate attempt by Linda Hazard's spirit to maintain a connection with the mortal realm? Numerous legends and tales surround Starvation Heights, some easily debunked. One such myth suggests that for every life claimed by Linda Hazard, she planted a tree. A stand of nearly 100 large trees located some distance from the cabin was often believed to represent her victims. In truth, these trees belonged to a separate plot of land and were planted by a local landowner unrelated to Hazard's gruesome deeds. Other rumors suggested that Hazard continued her killing spree during the 1920s when she operated the larger sanitarium. All that remains of this facility today are a concrete foundation and a rusting trash incinerator. While there were whispers that she burned bodies in the incinerator, the close scrutiny imposed by authorities during that time makes this claim highly unlikely. The cottage that once stood at Starvation Heights has vanished, leaving behind unanswered questions about the spirits that may have lingered within its walls. Whether these spirits are the restless souls of Linda Hazard or her unfortunate patients is a mystery that remains unsolved. The hunger we have for answers to these questions will always persist, but it seems that they will forever just be slightly out of reach. Nestled in the heart of a historic town, where cobblestone streets wind their way through rows of charming buildings, lies the Oxford Saloon. With roots dating back to the turn of the century, this old establishment carries with it a sense of history and intrigue that beckons curious souls to step inside. Originally, the building housed a humble dry goods store, catering to the needs of the townsfolks. But as the years passed and the town grew, so did the aspirations of its inhabitants. The dry goods store underwent a transformation, morphing into a popular saloon that became synonymous with revelry and entertainment. Renovations and additions were made to the building over time, breathing new light into its weathered facade. A second floor was added, boasting rooms intended for weary travelers seeking respite in the form of a boarding house. However, whispers soon spread like wildfire through the narrow streets, hinting at a clandestine purpose for these rooms. Rumor has it that a powerful businesswoman, known for her influence and connections, used these very rooms for secret rendezvous with her associates from the nearby Eagle's Lodge. As the saloon's reputation grew, so did its darker side. The basement, a dimly lit room beneath this raucous revelry on the main floor, became a hotbed of violence. Card games played out in smoky corners often turned heated, leading to brawls that stained the air with tension and spilled blood. It was in the basement that tragedy struck one fateful night, claiming the life of a policeman who, when he was off duty, worked there as a bouncer. Some claim that his spirit still lingers within those walls, forever trapped in the echoes of his final moments. Visitors speak of encountering his presence on the creaking stairs or catching glimpses of him in the mirrored reflection of the ladies' restroom. Nowadays, the second floor serves as a more practical purpose, housing various offices for local businesses. Yet, despite the mundane nature of these spaces, whispers persist that they are haunted by three apparitions. One is a man with a curious air about him, his bowler hat perched jauntily on his head, as if forever guarding a secret. The two women, forever tied to the saloon's dark past, are said to have met tragic fates. One was a wealthy businesswoman who once ruled over the town with an iron fist, her power and influence unmatched. The other was a woman forced into a life of prostitution, her existence marked by hardship and despair that ultimately led to a gruesome end. In 2005, a group of paranormal investigators ventured into the depths of the Oxford Saloon. Armed with their equipment and a thirst for answers, they embarked on a journey that would test the boundaries of their beliefs. As they delved into the saloon's mysteries, strange sounds reverberated through their recording devices. A male voice responding to their request for photographic evidence echoed through the cold air. And faintly, in the distant background, the eerie sound of a child's laughter or sobbing sent shivers down their spines. Undeterred by these spectral encounters, and having far more balls than I do, the investigators were granted access to all the offices on the top floor. However, as they attempted to unlock certain rooms, their efforts met inexplicable resistance. Keys slipped from their grasp as if guided by an unseen hand, taunting them with their elusiveness. And from the playback of the recordings emerged a voice, claiming ownership of its own room and mocking the investigators with its ethereal presence. Determined to uncover the truth, they pressed onward, exploring every nook and cranny of the second floor. But their courage was met with a commanding male voice that reverberated through their microphones, declaring itself as the One. Chilled to the core, they retreated, seeking solace in each other's presence. Thank God they got out of there. Yet even as they regrouped with two additional investigators downstairs, a haunting farewell bid them death, echoing through the depths of their souls. Summoning their remaining strength, the investigators ventured into the basement. Why? You have to venture to the front door and out into your car and down the road and back onto the plane and home. They descended the worn steps with trepidation. One of them, armed with a bazooka, captured 10 snapshots in quick succession. When they reviewed the images, their astonishment knew no bounds. In one photo, an apparition of a man stared directly at them, his eyes piercing through the veil that separates the living from the dead. Seeking validation, they consulted a professional photographer who commented that no alterations had been made to the images, leaving them with an undeniable testament to the supernatural. After the investigation, one of the members rushed to the bathroom looking for relief, which is much further than I would have made it. I subscribe to the, if you're in that kind of situation, the pants is good enough. He was greeted by a mysterious voice whispering in his ear, "Get out." Without hesitation, he remembered to zip up his pants, which is also a step that I would have surely ignored, and hightailed it out of there. Going forward, you should probably skip that extra large coffee before an investigation. Or just, you know, stay home. I'm Christopher Feinstein, and this is Haunted American History. I would like to give a shout out to the newest member of the Patreon, John. Thank you so much for joining. Your support means the world to me. I say it every time I get a new member, and I mean it every time I get a new member. The members are the heart and soul of this show. Thank you all so much for being here. Thank you for believing in me, and thank you for the support. If you'd like to join the Patreon, patreon.com/hauntedamericanhistory, ad-free episodes, early releases, and my eternal gratitude. Thank you so much, and that's all for today, folks. Until next time, later.